Hi, from Issaquah, Washington, you're listening to Deepak Singh.
And from Cambridge, Massachusetts, this is Hari Jaira.
And you're listening to The Coast.
The Coast.
Bio. Podcast.
Podcast.
Hey, Hari, how are you?
I am very, very fine. It's super, super muggy over here. And my AC doesn't seem to be working, but I have a fan going. So hopefully noise cancellation algorithms are really what they're cracked up to be.
Yeah, and I can't hear it anymore. I could earlier. Earlier, when we started talking, it looked like you were standing outdoors and there was wind flowing by you. But right now it sounds perfectly fine, at least in my headset. Yeah, I mean, this is we've actually recorded 2 weeks in a row, which is amazing.
I know. It feels like almost strange. It feels like we recorded like 4 days back or something.
Yeah,
but it's really good to get back into the flow of things.
Yeah, absolutely. And hopefully, you know, although I have some, I don't have any planned travel right now, so you never know. But I'm glad things are, you know, hopefully for the next few weeks, we'll be able to get in a good flow and get a few episodes out. We actually have still one episode that we recorded and we never put up. I think what I'll do is go through it, see if it still makes sense or if it sounds too dated. If it sounds completely out of context, I will not put it up. If it sounds all right, I might put it up with a little bit of a caveat recording up front saying this was a previous, recovered from the files of the great recordings and masters of C2C Bio.
Digitally remastered for your pleasure.
Yeah, absolutely. Found in the vault. Yeah.
Who knows? If you actually record like every single week, then we'll never have to have an opportunity to do that ever again. That's also a good
thing.
It's
possible. Maybe we'll bring it up in one of these weeks then when nobody is there. I was actually thinking that a week that one of us is not available, the other person should just do a quick monologue or bring a guest on and talk to them. You know, just find a guest. Pick up Suresh or Shalja or somebody like that.
Oh, yeah, definitely. You
know, pick up Ice. Get him.
Or we could just do voices and stuff.
Yeah. No, it was funny. The last Floss Weekly, at least the last one I heard, had Leo, Randall, and what's the... Jono Bacon. Who's been the guest, a host for a while. And this time he was also the guest. And
the Jaunty Jackalope.
Yeah, yeah, it was a great episode. Yeah.
Oh, I haven't heard that.
I'm actually
ready. To be frank.
Go ahead. Go ahead.
No, I don't like the ones when Leo's not there because I just think.
Oh, no, he's there. Anyway. He's there.
But they for a couple of episodes, it was just at least two episodes. It was Randall Schwartz and Jono Bacon. And for some reason, Jono Bacon sounds very probing in his question.
Yeah, no. It apparently, so who did the interview? They interviewed somebody and Leo actually made fun of him and this said that you were really harsh on that guy.
I'm sure it's probably the Inkscape one, but
I think it was not Inkscape, it was somebody else, or maybe it was Inkscape. Uh-huh. But
it's somebody
Jono used to work with.
Oh, goodness. No, it really sounded... I mean, I was like, you know, that's why I said I miss Leo Laporte in that show, because whenever, even when they ask harsh questions, they don't sound harsh.
Yeah.
But it is probably a combination of a harsh-sounding question with an Australian/British accent, you know?
Yeah. Well, and Leo, no, I mean, Leo's been doing this for a long time. No, this one was funny because they started off by saying, you know, you are a guest host, but you're also a guest, so we can shut up and you can ask yourself questions. it was funny. It was a good...
So it is about Jaunty Jackalope?
Yeah, actually, I have a blog post on it coming up. Not sort of related to Ubuntu. It is sort of inspired by what role Canonical is playing in the Ubuntu ecosystem. And I was thinking of companies in the scientific software space. You know, we have academic groups that develop software and academic consortiums that develop software. And then we have companies like Accelerus, which in-license software, companies like Schrodinger, which work very closely with an academic lab, and essentially the commercial wing, but they do a lot of their own work. And then you have,
you have the NThoughts and the Global Phasing.
Yeah.
There's quite a lot of them.
Yeah,
actually.
So it's very fragmented, but I think there's a core group of algorithms that should really benefit from sort of a distributed model. So, for example, the part that really got me thinking was Ubuntu has between 50,000 to 100,000 active contributors.
Wow.
Yeah, that's incredible. And Canonical's role is basically to act as the project manager. And they hire some of the best guys. They actually fund them. They actually fund specific projects which will make Ubuntu better. You know, so from that perspective, I think it's an interesting model. And what also got me thinking about it was the fact that Agilent is just funding Cytoscape development. So.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I think that you know, like Synesis, right? Isn't that the Synesis and Glaxo funded a lot of PyMOL development.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, like,
but these things are done kind of ad hoc. By having a body or a non-profit or some entity whose sort of role is like, say, take the best of the breed informatics and soft algorithms, you know, for that a community needs, and make sure that there's a community of developers around them, manage the releases, you know, and do something along those lines. Interesting thought.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think the reason we don't see too much of that is because, well, I think there's still not that much open source.
Yeah.
At least in biology, like crystallography is very open source friendly, but
bioinformatics is very open source friendly. Chemistry is not.
So I wonder why not. Chemistry, oh yeah, you guys are notorious.
Yeah, chemistry is horrible. But for example, take Charm, for example, right? There's a small, it's not open source. It's you get the source code when you get the academic version, but it's not an open source project. You have a small group of people who sort of control and manage it. But if you could make it a more distributed project, it would be so much more effective.
I think the reason, so like the CCP4, right, which is the big collection of software that crystallographers use, it's open source as well, exactly as you were saying about Charm, but it's not distributed in the sense that I guess, you know, you could kind of write up stuff and they would incorporate it into the code base, but it's not distributed. It's just
so what you need is a core body that is interested in this upfront. It could be a commercial company, it could be a, you know, Ubuntu is a company, but their role is to promote free software. You know, Ubuntu is still free, right? Open source. I mean, they make their money in other ways, but finding the right developers, if there's specific parts of the software that they want to spend money on, like packet managers, synaptic things like that. You know, they do things like that's what they do. And I think it's an interesting model to look at. It'll not work for everything. It'll work for a few projects. It would work really well for something like R, for example.
Right. Something as universal as that. Yeah. But, you know, thinking even in terms of, I don't think our developer communities and our even user communities are that big that, you know, it'll scale that well.
And that's the challenge. But I think for certain things, it might. You know, just because...
R, I think, Well, R, it's definitely, it's open and it is scaling, right? I mean, there's like
there's
hundreds
other
of
applications.
People.
But but I also think that's what leads to a lot of fragmentation.
Which is good.
It is good and it's bad, right? If you have... So right now, and even within code, it leads to fragmentation. For example, different people have different versions of Charm floating around. Different people have different versions of various codes floating around. They're not in sync. You know, they don't have compatibility with each other and things like that. Instead of having 20 different molecular dynamics codes or 25 different alignment codes that do essentially the same thing, you could have open source modular systems where you have a few people. You know, where people are trying to make that better now, and you can fork it if you don't like the direction.
I just think there's not that much of a developer.
And that's always a challenge. I think our communities are really small. I think part of the reason they've been small to some extent is historical. I think the other reason why they might be small is that we try and it's always controlled by a few people. We don't make it available to everybody.
I mean, even we always talk how even like version control and stuff, right, is so unheard of that it's very hard to collaborate if, you know, you're emailing each other source files or something like that, you know. So you don't make it available or you just make it so difficult to easily hook into the system that it discourages people rather than encourages them.
I'll stick to communities that I know well. A lot of them weren't using source control till very recently. Or you have communities that are really small, which is okay. This happens in the open source world also. There's projects that are small and only a few people care about. But there's other projects that enough people care about that I think having what would be great is have a company or an entity that it takes, you know, takes a bunch of, say, takes molecular dynamics. They choose best of breed packages for doing molecular simulation and molecular modeling. And they decide that they're going to fund them. They're going to fund development. They're going to be the organizers. And then you would have a full suite. You know, Accelerus kind of does that, but the model that is there is not the one that works, in my opinion.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I think it hopefully will come organically out of, you know, like bioinformatics consortia. Like, I don't know, Cytoscape, for example, right, is a good example. That's what you were saying, right? Isn't that a whole bunch of labs that jointly develop Cytoscape?
But primarily from the Triadiker lab in San Diego.
Right.
But yeah,
I mean,
but
other focus.
I mean, I think R is the best. If you had to do it, R would be the first place to start, I would say.
Right. And I think in crystallography, there's a lot of examples. I mean, Pymol, most of those have a focal point, but there's a lot of people writing plugins and so on.
But
and
the
things that hook into...
Yeah, but the business models around that are not there. They sort of incentivize people. Other than, hey, I need to get... You know, in the charm world, when do somebody write something? When they need to fix it. You know, they need something for themselves. But there's no there's no quality control. You can fork a version and use it for yourself. That's fine. But things that can get rolled on to the community in general, you know, having procedures in place, or if there's... Like, I'll use that example. You want to get it to scale better. Somebody who's interested, has a vested interest in making scale, then funds it, spends the money on it, make sure it's scaling. Things like that.
Yeah. Well, hopefully as awareness and the, what do you call, competence of, you know, everyday developers increases, there'll be more and more people wanting to contribute.
And I think that's what is promising, is that I think the quality of developers and the number of people who know how to write good code is as opposed to hacks, is increasing. Because it's become such an important part of what we do. And sort of segueing from that, I think we were going to study, to start off by talking about projects that we were interested in, but why don't we just segue into our first story here?
Yeah, that sounds good.
Yeah, and it's a blog post by Tim Bray, who was at Sun, and I have no idea if he's going to go on with Sun to Oracle. But I've actually heard Tim Bray speak on stage. And he's a fun talker. He's a great guy to listen to. He gave a talk at last year's OSCON, I think, on Ruby and JRuby. Even though he works at Sun, he doesn't write any code in Java. He doesn't believe in... He believes that the day of the statically typed language is over. Or at least he feels more comfortable with dynamic typing. He has a really nice article where he proposes a curriculum for computer science, which doesn't cover every... I mean, it's not a comprehensive curriculum, but it's essentially a curriculum that's driven by the kind of skills you need and understanding you need to have to be in the sort of in the web scale era, the kind of programming that a lot of people do today. And I found it quite interesting. Now, you know, I've never studied computer science, but if I was wanting to learn stuff today, the curriculum that he has designed, it almost, I almost feel like, hey, I should go back and if I, you know, you can self use some of his curriculum, find the appropriate books and resources in those areas and sort of teach yourself also.
Right. And this is a very good template actually to, as you said, right, go and look at like MIT's open courseware and stuff. They have some of the courses that overlap with this. But also, you know, even if you pick any book up, right, it's a good template to use to kind of concentrate on sections of that book. Can you hear that stupid car alarm going off? All right, I'm trying to walk away.
Haven't you had a car broken into about 5 times?
Hey, speaking of my car getting broken into, remember how you made that joke about... how I should get myself a new phone. Or I shouldn't get myself a phone because I keep losing them and they get stolen from my car because my window gets broken and so on. Well, I got a new phone. I finally got an iPhone.
3GS or 3G?
Yeah, the new one, the 3GS.
The 3GS.
It was my birthday present.
Oh, yeah. I forgot that you had one recently.
Yes. So, yeah, I mean, I have all of... zero apps on it right now, but let's see.
There's a few apps that almost must have. I mean, for me, the apps that I use the most are Evernote, which I use all the time because I use Evernote for all my notes on my desktop as well. There are a couple of others. Trippet I use a lot. A couple others that I'm not being able to think of right now that I use heavily. And of course, TweetDeck, Friend Feed, things like
I
that.
see. Yeah, maybe
So.
one of these days we'll get you to talk about, apps you use. The only
Yeah.
because now I have a vested interest.
Yeah. No, cool.
No,
Congratulations.
thank you, thank you. I feel I'm finally catching up with is it the Joneses? That's the saying? I think so.
Yeah,
Yeah.
pretty. Yeah, one of the negatives of having an iPhone now is that wherever you go, the iPhone's everywhere. I
Yeah.
mean, every time I fly, pretty much everyone, at least half the plane has an iPhone.
Yeah, exactly.
If you know, like, at least I have a funky case for it, so it looks
Well,
different.
I got a case just like, well, me and my wife, well, Geeta, both of us got cases, identical ones. So,
Yeah.
well, she put a flower on her wallpaper
Yeah.
so that we
Well,
can tell them apart.
my wallpaper has Mount Rainier on it, so.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that's cool. So,
Yeah.
anyway, why were you talking about iPhones? Oh, anyway,
I
iPhone.
think you were talking about the
Oh,
car
car
alarm.
alarm. Right, right, right.
Yeah,
Yeah, yes.
that's called going into a rat hole,
Yeah.
right?
Right, exactly.
Anyway, so getting back to Tim Bray, and obviously we link to the show notes, but sort of quickly letting the people who are hearing this find out a little more about
Hey, we should actually
what
just
you,
go through some of the,
yeah, yeah, yeah,
the.
the items on there.
Right.
So he starts off with the typical things, architecture, but here the architecture is the architecture of the web, HTML, CSS, HTTP, URIs. So essentially the underlying architecture of the web, which I think is almost essential, especially in a world where you have linked data and REST,
Right.
and where HTTP is like the most fundamental thing out there. Then the next one is the one that I think everyone has to study, which is data structures and algorithms. I think here the additional flavor is the document object model, as opposed to just the traditional data structures. Perhaps the parts that appeal to me the most, or which are almost typically web centric, are protocols on the web. So HTTP style message exchange, things like WebDAV, XMPP, ATOMPub, PubSub.
That's the 320 one, right? Application protocols, right?
Web 320. And then the next one is data formats, so JSON and
Yeah.
XML. There's Web 351. Security, because web security is its own beast.
Right.
But perhaps the most interesting things for me were Web 470 and 480.
I like 480. That sounds like that's
And
concurrent
those,
systems, right? Yeah.
those were the ones that really, really appealed to me. I mean, for example, just thinking about Web 470, which is issues in large distributed systems. It's REST, object naming, caching, partitioning, crawling, functional programming, handling errors, understanding things like Erlang and MapReduce, learning how to write a web crawler. These are the kind of things that I see every day in my day job, and not everybody really understands them equally well.
Very few do, right? I mean,
Luckily now there's frameworks that help you, things like Hadoop and things like Lucene, which we'll talk about shortly. They sort of abstract out some of the challenges, but in the end, an application or website is not going to scale until you understand
right.
scaling, right? And being able to understand those things is really, really important, and I think it's going to become even critically important as we get more web-centric in how we interact
And
with data, interact with systems, interact with
I
people.
think I actually misspoke. If you look at the MIT OpenCourseWare, you'll find very little of all of this. I mean, I guess you'll find data structures and algorithms, but the rest of it, they don't teach you in, I don't even think they teach you in grad school,
Yeah, no, I
You,
think that's what makes this
yeah.
so interesting is that they don't.
Yeah.
And
And that's what he's
they are
saying. You need a
very.
web-based curriculum almost because these are technologies that are evolving and they are out here on the web, so put them all up here, right? Isn't that what he's talking about basically?
Yeah, and I think what he's. The other thing I liked about this was it's not a programming curriculum.
Correct.
It's basic fundamentals of what you should be knowing. I think concurrent systems is very, very interesting. I know threads, processes, actors, message passing, understanding things like you know, Scala and Erlang, and then Java and Ruby, and so on and so forth, and sort of implementing concurrent platforms and learning these new technologies. I wish I had the time to go into all of this because it's fascinating. You know, he says, he talks about areas where a web-centric curriculum would not help. And he's very honest about where it works and where it doesn't work. Computer graphics, object orientation, real-time software, numerical, you know, stuff, AI, computer systems architectures, algorithm analysis. But I think those you have covered today, a lot of it. You need to have this other dimension. I actually think that a lot of these electives are things that even scientists should actually think about, especially computational scientists.
Right. Distributed systems, yeah. Concurrent systems. Yeah, this is like really the meat of developing large scalable, you know, things. And you never find them. I mean, it's like these are things you, as you said, very, very few people know well.
I keep trying to find some of these things. And it's hard because you have all these blogs and articles, but there's sort of no comprehensive resource. There's no Kernian and Ritchie.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, I'm hoping that Tom White's book on Hadoop becomes that, at least in some ways.
And I think, a lot of these are so new, right? I mean, and you know, when you do, say, like REST, right? You try to learn REST. It's very hard to, I guess, get it unless you build a big system, you know, and you watch the design of a system. And even the books that try to teach you REST, they are more, I guess, they don't really do a good job of they're more like recipe books, you know, they're not really design books.
Yeah, I completely agree. And it's interesting I think recipe books only go so far. I think it's very important to understand some of the core concepts, especially for things like scaling.
Right.
You can't just implement it. You need to understand your algorithm. You need to understand your application and what you're trying to do.
Mm.
Yeah. So, I mean, I really, really like that article.
And the link will be in the show notes.
Yes, absolutely. There's enough programmer types who listen to us. I'd be very interested in your feedback. And talking of programmer types, sort of jumping on to our next story, one of our own, Jan Ayerts, who's at Sanger, and Andy Law, I guess, who's at Roslyn, which I don't know where it is, have an article in BMC Bioinformatics called An Introduction to Scripting in Ruby for Biologists. I actually haven't quite gone through the article. I know they talk about simple examples, metaprogramming, database access. I think sort of speaking to a Perl-centric audience and showing them what you can do with Ruby. And what I liked about it was it got published in BMC, so people are going to read it. Talks about BioRuby. It'll be, as of somebody who likes Ruby, where, and in a world where Perl and Python are still the primary languages, it's good to see journals and people sort of, especially people like Jan, who are practitioners, trying to make it accessible to the community.
I mean, I don't even think, like, I think, you know, Perl's pretty much still rules the roost, you know, as for in bioinformatics. Even Python's probably a distant second, and Ruby's, you know.
Way back. I mean, I would say Perl and Java are the two dominant languages.
Right, exactly.
In this world.
So, yeah, this is, I don't really get time to read much of BMC Bioinformatics, but they have a lot of, I read about the BioPDB parser and all that stuff recently. Very.
And was it in BMC or was it somewhere else where?
I thought it was in BMC.
Matt Wood's editorial was in Bioinformatics, not in BMC Bioinformatics. I think Bioinformatics is in Elsevier. Journal.
I see. Okay.
So that was there. Editorial on cloud computing. I've sort of used to read BMC a bit back in the day. Now I hardly read anything unless it shows up on friend feed or someplace. So it was good to see. Good to see it there, and maybe I'll read it too, just for the heck of it. See what they talk about and how deep they get.
There is a Ruby project, right?
Yeah, and I think Jan's actively involved with it, as is who's a guy at Stanford,
Dudley?
I forget his name.
Joel Dudley?
Joel Dudley. Uh-huh. I think Joel might be involved with it as well. But I definitely know that Jan's involved with it. And you can get BioRuby on GitHub. I don't know if it's a core BioRuby project or a fork, but you can get it there.
I think BioPython's also on GitHub now. Or at least on what the Mercurial one is. Oh, wow. The BioRuby site looks very nice. Very, very coolly red and Ruby-like.
Yeah, the red is always there, right?
Oh, is it? Yeah, yeah. I, as you probably know, I don't do or see much Ruby nowadays.
And so it's cool. We have a couple of other sort of programming type stories. The other one, and it sort of takes...
Oh, the next one we should spend some time on, yeah.
That takes directly from sort of a web-centric curriculum because it talks about search, is one of our favorite programming geeks out there, Pierre Lindenbaum, has a blog post on indexing and searching NCBI genes with Apache Lucene. Do you want to jump into it? Because I've been doing all the talking.
Go ahead, continue, Deepak, because I have not read this one, so.
Okay, so why don't I just ask you, so, you know, how much do you know about Lucene and...
Well, apart from the fact that I've always wanted to go into... So Lucene is Apache's Java-based search solution, right? It's basically you build an index so you can throw your data on it, and Apache Lucene is basically a Java library which will catalog all that information and put it into some sort of structure from which you can build like endpoints, like, right? You can build search endpoints into. That's basically Apache Lucene, right? So, and I know like a lot
Unstructured text search.
Right, and I know a lot of like the wiki that we use on BioScreencast that uses Lucene. Then Krugel, the website Krugel, and there's like several enterprises that are built entirely on Lucene.
Yeah.
Actually, I know like Mendeley uses Lucene for its PDF search. So yeah, it's everywhere where you need to build a searchable index, and that's all I know about Lucene.
I also think that Lucene was developed either by Doug Cutting or Tom White, both of whom are actively involved with Hadoop, so it comes from the same people.
I see.
So Lucene is ubiquitous. I mean, most people building search indexes out there, I would say a big chunk are using Lucene.
Right.
Or higher level abstractions of Lucene like Solr. And it's good to see a practical example of how you can use Lucene to do something like searching in CBI. And I think it's very using the example that Pierre has out there, you can, I think, easily extend this to other resources as well and build a search engine internally. For example, if you're building a search engine for your internal data resources at a company or at a university or even at a lab where search and data data querying is really important and you want a consistent, maybe annotated version of it. So you need to build an index. And this is a great way of doing it. And as Pierre ends his post with, that's it. And if you know, it's great to see. This is goes back to recipes. It's a recipe to how you would use Lucene for searching a core bioinformatics resource.
Yeah, or a core, any searchable text resource, right?
Yeah. Any unstructured text resource, you know, you can apply it to. And of course, his example talks goes specifically into the XML and gene IDs and so on. So it's designed to be searching a bioinformatics. I mean, I don't know any Java, so the code makes only so much sense to me. So it'll probably make more sense to you. But basically, his source is XML entry gene entries. He's related to initiation of translation. So he downloaded all of these from NCBI.
Right.
And he's basically indexed XML using Lucene. And I think if you have the right endpoints in XML and you have some idea of the structure, you can index. I mean, you can do things like take NCBI, take EBI data, take other SwissProt, whatever, and index all of it and sort of cross-index it and build a search engine for your own purposes, right?
Yeah, which is a very fun activity, actually. I've always wanted to do one of these for, the CCP4 newsgroup, because there's you know, a lot of news group search, I feel, does not involve, does not bias the results in ways that are sensible to people who use the news group. To give you an example, right, in the CCB4 news group, the crystallography news group, every time you query, you know, say if I want to query on a program called, you know, there's a program called Scala, right? It's not the programming language. Now, it'll be great to, you know, it forces me to say Scala and Phil Evans, who happens to be the author of Scala. So every time I search, I have to say Scala and Phil Evans, but it'll be nice to build a search index that has kind of the wisdom of the community built in. So if I am searching for Scala, you know, and say there's a reply that contains other keywords from Phil Evans, that's probably going to be better because he wrote the program. So, you know, things like that, I've always wanted to play with, like, you know, unleashing like Lucene on building your custom index for a data set, like say the archive of the last 20 years of CCB4. And that'll be of tremendous benefit to any community, like kind of putting your biases. So, you know, the top 10 authors in a particular field, and you have like, say, you know, a whole bunch of PDFs or a whole bunch of papers in that field. It'll be good to put in your kind of metrics and build yourself something, which I'm sure will be very usable. So anyway, yeah, no, Lucene's a great technology. There's also, have you heard of Apache Jackrabbit? I think that's kind of like the...
Jackrabbit? No, let me quickly search for it.
Yeah, I think talking. Apache Jackrabbit's, it's like the presentation layer on... Or Jackrabbit's more content management?
It's a content... Yeah, it's a content repository.
Right, it's kind of like you can use Lucene to build your index, and then when you want to like... do things like converting search into content, then you can use Jackrabbit. And so I've always been, you know, say that I want to really learn Lucene and Jackrabbit because that's whole stack.
Yeah, I actually haven't heard that much of Jackrabbit. What I've heard a lot about, and I know people use a lot, is Solr, which is a search server based on the Lucene Java library. So basically what Solr does is you query it via HTTP GET and you get XML results back.
I see.
So it gives you advanced full text search. It's optimized for high volume web traffic. Mm-hmm. It has admin interfaces. It does monitoring. It scales well, and it's very flexible. It sort of sits on top of Lucene. It uses the library and extends it to a proper day with a data schema. It has numeric types, dynamic fields. You don't have to do any of that yourself. With Lucene, you just get the raw index, right?
Right.
You have to do... The other thing that I know a lot of people using increasingly is something called Mahout, which is a machine learning system. Uh-huh. A machine learning combines sort of Lucene with Hadoop. So Mahout is built on top of Hadoop. It's a machine learning system. So a lot of people are... So there's all these new systems
you mean
in
like,
place.
Like that's like Mahout, right? I mean, like Indian...
The elephant
Mahout. Someone who rides an elephant, right? Okay.
Yeah, exactly.
I thought you said Mahout. I thought it's like a mega Hadoop.
That's the Canadian version.
Oh, okay. This is very nice, actually. This is a great example. I mean, it's kind of a perfect how-to on how to get started with Apache Lucene. Thanks a lot, Pierre. This is awesome.
Yeah. So for those of you who actually know Java, go for it. Sort of the second flavor of our podcast today, sort of the yin to the programming yang, is data and data visualization. And it stems from a blog post that is... from June of earlier this year, from a blog that I really, really like called Flowing Data. And the blog post is called Rise of the Data Scientist. And he starts off by quoting Google's chief economist, Hal Varian, who said that the next sexy job in the next 10 years would be statisticians. And if I look at what people in our field do, if people in other fields, a lot of what they do is data analysis, data mining. And it's been like that for a few years. I think we've talked about whether too much data mining is the right thing. And, you know, people are forgetting about the fundamental science and models behind it. But there is a whole data community that's coming up. You know, which is not just about statistics and data mining and data munging. There's a third part to it also, is data visualization. That's the kind of stuff that people like Ben Fry have really pushed, made more accessible. And, you know, Flowing Data talks about the various aspects of being a data scientist, but treats visualization as a first-class citizen in that field. And I remember being at a talk at BioIT World last year where a guy from Pfizer gave a talk on data visualization and how they needed that visualization to actually make decisions from the data that the statisticians generated. Because without the visualization, not a lot of the biologists and the bench scientists and the decision makers of statistics can really understand the data coming from the statisticians. Right. So they need to look at it as, and it gets really complex because a lot of it is multidimensional.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, from that perspective, I was wondering what you thought the role of visualization in science was and, you know, how it's going to evolve in crystallography. Visualization is really important.
Right. And so, and I think, yeah. You know, it's there's the end-to-end stack is what I think it's so important, right? That's what he says. A statistician is not just someone who just is, you know, the traditional analysis that you're used to thinking about, but the visual, the data munging, which is obviously, I think, which is probably the easiest of the three, and the visualization, I think, is the killer one that can make or break anything. You know, if it wasn't for great visualization in crystallography, you know, it would take us months and months to do these things. And now, you know, thanks to things like PyMOL and Coot and, you know, the several other visualization environments out there, it's getting a lot easier to, like, ask very probing questions on even structural data, which is anyway very visual. I mean, the hard part, of course, is data that's not very visual, like, say, gene data or, you know, array data and stuff, and adapting visualization to that. And that's where, like, yeah, processing and, you know, Ben Fry and all their stuff is, I think that's going to be so important that, you know, the statistics can, I think, come kind of as, it has to be concurrent, of course. And I think, yeah, I agree. It's the big challenge. And I think that's the hardest part. You know, you can find, like, you can spend, I think, wait, a few afternoons and get the statistics part right. But the visualization, I think, is needs a part of the brain that's, you know, been dormant during those afternoons when you're doing the statistics and the munging part, you know. So
yeah,
no, I think there's, yeah, almost,
I think it's a different skills, I think it's a different,
yeah,
skill
it
set
is
as
and,
well.
And if you don't have it in the future with these data sets getting that large, or the ability to link the two up seamlessly and very well, you know, it's that's the real challenge. And actually, in that sense, it's not that much of a challenge in crystallography because the data is already same, pretty darn visual to start with, you know, when you get a coordinates.
Yeah.
But
I've seen some of these, yeah, I've seen some in cheminformatics, for example, I've seen some of these very multidimensional data sets where you have, you know, that's where I think SpotFire does so well because you have so much flexibility into how you can visualize your data. But even then, having someone decide what's the right way to visualize this data and come up with the right decision, what type of visualization gives you the most information, that's non-trivial because people just go to their heat maps or something like that, right? Or to their scatter plots or their principal component
exactly.
analysis. They're the standards that they always go to. And they may not be the right answer. You might be missing things. And having people who know how to look at multidimensional data sets and large data sets and distill them down so that you can get the pick up the signals and get the information you want is critical. And I'm not much of a visualization guy. I mean, in that most of the data I'm used to seeing historically is best seen using a simple 2D plot. But but I think it's with bioinformatics data, I've definitely seen some of the challenges in trying to slice and dice it.
Very cool. So
yeah.
And going along with the theme of visualization is the next thing we want to talk about, which is a whole bunch of kind of like a compendium of very striking and exciting visualizations that are out there. And it covers basically, you know, visualizations. It's not language centric. It's across the board. There is a lot of JavaScript here, which is really, and Flash, of course, which I think are really, really pervasive, right, in the visualization space. And
I mean, although I almost feel, I mean, HTML5 is trying to go away from that, but yeah.
I don't know. I've heard quite a few talks in the last couple of weeks, which really, really question, you know, the whole HTML5 way of whether it's really going to be that much of a do we need it kind of thing, you know?
I mean, it's the question goes down to how, you know, if you want it a web-centric way or is Flash okay? And mostly it's an anti-Flash movement, right? Because a lot of people don't like a lot about Flash. I mean, JavaScript is okay. I don't think anybody has issues with JavaScript. People do seem to have issues with Flash. And I'm kind of ambivalent. I don't really care as long as it works.
Yeah, I'm like that too. And, you know, I think the problem with... it's like, I hate to bring this, like the example of SVG, right? It's perfect, of course. You know, but it's I don't know. You don't see that much of it, you know? So then, what do you do?
Yeah,
you know, there's not...
I've been in situations where you chose SVG and people didn't care.
Right.
They didn't want it.
Yeah. And so I think, you know, you pick the one you're most familiar with, and I think the power will come from how quickly you can bring about, you know, link up your data to the visualization. And if it takes you forever and if you're sitting there like, you know, the speed of which you can do things, I think is very important when your data sets are that big. I don't know. I'm pretty agnostic. I mean, I don't care about which one I pick, but I definitely want, you know, the documentation to be spectacular, because visualization is pretty darn hard. In fact, I had a post on FriendFeed asking for, you know, libraries. I'm doing some stuff which we may talk about later in this show, but I spent 3 days just reading up Matplotlib and, you know, Report Lab and a bunch of other visualization systems out there, and I still feel like I picked the wrong one, you know, because it's hard to do, I guess, you know. But this is a very good list of libraries and approaches that have successfully visualized various datasets like Delicious and Flickr and all these other ones.
Yeah. So which one did you like the most?
You know, the one I like the most is the one that the guy says he lost the Delicious. I forget, it's some Indian guy. I'm looking through the list. He said he lost all his code, and his computer crashed. But the visualizations are spectacular, and I'm thinking of emailing the guy. Which one's your favorite one?
I mean, just on sheer looks, I really like the sort of these very complex graphs. So, for example, the...
Actually, where's that link?
Structure of the Internet and the Opti project, which maps every Class C network on the infrastructure from a single computer and a single Internet connection.
Uh-huh.
So you create a map of the entire Internet. That's really, really cool. But in reality, I think the one that I really like is the there's one from Nature, and the other one that I really like is the Walrus one. So these, again, it's a 3D graph, massive graph in a 3D interface.
I see.
I tend to like graphs, connect things that connect to each other, where you can sort of drill down into connections,
right?
Sort of traverse them. I tend to like a lot.
Yeah, and I like the whole network analysis kind of, you know, the A talks to B, talks to C kind of.
Yeah.
The cloud things a lot.
Yeah. Those are really, really like. I actually also like the sort of the heat map type things, the news maps, where you can see current headlines in different sizes and different colors. I actually use that. I used to use that a bit.
Mm-hmm. Very cool. So, which is a very graphics and programming heavy discussion.
I think we sort of deliberately did it this way. And actually, sticking to graphics, it's a website that I actually like a lot. I've blogged about it. I've had a chance to see it. And that's a website called wellformed.eigenfactor.org, well-formed.eigenfactor.org. Eigenfactor Project is sort of this project from at the University of Washington that takes from Carl Bergstrom's group, that takes data from Thomson Reuters and essentially builds... allows you to do all kinds of very interesting graphical graph theory based analysis of connectivity between authors. It's a different way of looking at citations. I think we've talked about it before as well.
Yeah, we have, right, earlier on.
Yeah, so he's got all these very nice interactive visualization based on the eigenfactor metrics. And for example, let's take a look at the one that goes... in fact, I think some of these metrics are listed in the previous... might be even listed in the previous page. But the visualizations are fascinating. And talks, you know, you can see how people are connecting things together. In fact, I think the first one is definitely there. It's sort of connectivities between papers and so on and so forth from journal articles. It's a citation network, so to speak, and how things connect to each other. That's great. And then there's changing over time, how things change over time. That's fascinating. And of course, there's the map, which would be my favorite probably. And again, there are different ways of connecting data. And these are interactive maps. You can rotate them, you can drill down, you can log in, you can see, you can zoom into Journal of American Chemical Society and see what's near that. You can see Angawanti Chem right next to it and so on. It's beautiful. You know, Journal of Biological Chemistry is next to Current Opinions in Cell Biology and so on.
Right.
And so forth.
I think these guys are doing a great job, actually. I think we had a previous episode where we talked about who needs a new citation index or something. And I think I went on to say that I don't think we need a new citation index or whatever. But this eigenfactor people are doing a phenomenal job of analyzing, trends. And and this is very important stuff, and it's very scientific, and their method, I always wish I could understand the I guess statistics, or it's more like probability and stuff.
That it's graph theory.
Right, graph theory, that goes into it, it's one of those things on my mountainous to-do list.
Actually, this map is actually calculated with Cytoscape, and they've used something called FLAIR for the visualization, for all the visualizations. And what is FLAIR? FLAIR is data visualization. It's an ActionScript library that creates visualizations that run in a Flash player. Cool. It's available under a BSD license. Its design was adapted from its predecessor Prefuse, which is a toolkit for Java. So I think like things like FLAIR and processing and so on and so forth make there's a lot of interesting stuff out there. Oh, and the ManyEyes uses FLAIR as well.
Wow.
So that was our data visualization section. I think we'll end this data visualization section by talking about a little bit about a book that's coming out. It's called Beautiful Data. And it's a data-centric book. It's in line with a bunch of O'Reilly books, which start off with beautiful, beautiful code. I think there's beautiful something else. And there's Beautiful Data, which is edited by Toby Sigaran and Jeff Hammerbacher. Toby Sigaran wrote the Collective Intelligence O'Reilly book that so many of us have. And works at Freebase. He's their data magnate. That's what his business card says. And a really sharp guy, machine learning, intelligent, collective intelligence kind of person. And Jeff Hammerbacher comes from Facebook, and he currently works at Cloudera, and he's a, he's a data geek. I think he's actively involved with things like Hive, which we've talked about before, and especially at Cloudera. And so they've edited it, but what makes this book especially interesting is chapter number
30, is it? Is it?
No, chapter number 15.
It was 15.
And 16.
Right, there's two of them.
So chapter 15 is Life and Data, the Story of DNA by Matt Wood and Ben Blackburn. And chapter 16 is Beautifying Data in the Real World by Jean-Claude Bradley, Rajarshi Guha, Andrew Lang, Pierre Lindenbaum, Cameron Nalen, Anthony Williams, and Egon Billighagen. So as you can see, names that we all know really, really well. And it is quite good to see people from sort of our crowd in an O'Reilly book talking about data. It's fascinating stuff, and kudos to these guys for getting there. I'm actually very interested in chapter 7, and you can guess why.
Jeff Jonas?
Yeah, it's called Data Finds Data.
Is he Jonas or Jonas?
Jeff Jonas.
Okay, Joe.
I think.
Okay. Nah, this is awesome. Great. I mean, I can't. I'm glad I have it on Safari, so I'll definitely be reading at least the chapters from written by people I know directly.
Yeah, I'll be reading. Yeah, I'll be reading a lot of the book. I'm very interested in chapter 4. I'm very interested in chapter 5. I'm very interested in chapter 2. I'm very interested in chapter 1 as well. The whole thing. Just sort of, and of course, chapter 20.
Isn't some part of the book available as a downloadable PDF, like Creative Commons license? No,
might be. I just ordered it, pre-ordered it a long time ago, so I'm waiting for my printed.
Okay, yeah.
And the reason I ordered it was because people I know are on it.
Awesome. I have it bookmarked on my Safari library list, so this should be fun to read. It's always fun when you know people you know write a book, and it's good to read. So,
yeah, no, definitely. I mean, the moment I heard about this book and saw who the editors were, I'm like, I gotta have to get this book. And then I found out that, you know, Matt and Pierre and Jean-Claude and all these guys were on there, and I'm like, oh, I definitely have to get this book. So, yeah, I think that's our episode for today. Did you have any thing to add, or should we jump on to our
links
of the week?
We could jump on to our links of the week, actually.
So why don't you go ahead?
All right. So this link comes from thanks to – I'll put the credit in the show notes. But I had a question on FriendFeed about – I'm trying to do some visualization stuff. And actually, who was it? Michael Kuhn actually sent this link on to me. And I hadn't really seen this project, but it seems like it's a Python front end. It's called Summon. It's from MIT's CSAIL. So it's people.csail.mit.edu. So it's the visualization, prototyping, and scripting. The MIT Rasmus. I'm sorry, I don't know anything about MIT Rasmus and so on. But it is it's basically, I'll put a link, it's people.csail.mit.edu/rasmus/summon. And it's basically a Python library that hooks into, it's a Python extension module that's supposed to provide a very, very quick way of prototyping 2D visualizations. And, you know, if you look at all the examples they have on there, it's really cool. And what's even nicer is that a lot of the examples and the video are entirely centered around bioinformatics visualization. And they have these demos of these extremely high-performance OpenGL visualizations of, like, vast tree and map data. And the code examples they have makes it seem like it's very snappy to hook up, you know, very powerful OpenGL with this Pythonic front end, which is part of the whole Summon thing. So the features of this library are, you know, it has extremely fast OpenGL graphics and a Python extension module. And what I was interested in was SVG output, and along with, you know, GIF and also on using other libraries. So check out Summon which comes to you from one of the MIT labs. Maybe Rasmus is the name of the lab that it comes to you from. I need to read more, but
excellent. But it's very appropriate for today's episode.
Right.
As is mine. Earlier in this show, we talked about a story from flowingdata.com. And there's a project by Flowing Data called Your Flowing Data. You can find it at your.flowingdata.com. It actually makes use of Twitter. You actually make friends with, connect to YFD on Twitter, and they follow you back. And then you can send them a direct message. So you do DYFD something. You can say height or weight. And some number, and it shows up on your account there. You sign in using your Twitter credentials, and then you can decide what this metric is. It could be a measurement, it could be something else, and you can basically track things that you want to track. It actually then, once you're in the site, you can, whatever metrics that you've chosen to send it, then you can start visualizing them as a, you know, time series, a calendar, a tree map, a cloud, a log. It's a really neat project. An example of combining Twitter, data visualization and web service to sort of track, you know, I think things like weight or number of to-do items, which is what I'm tracking for fun, are great. So I really recommend people check it out. It's kind of neat. Your.flowingdata.com.
Awesome. Hey, this was a fun episode. I enjoyed it. It was a lot of visualization, a lot of programming, which is pretty much all I've been doing lately.
Yeah. And all I want to do, we'll talk about it perhaps in some other episode and some ideas that both of us have and how that might work. As always, you can get Coast to Coast Bio from iTunes or from spokenword.org. You can visit our website at c2cbio.com or I think a lot of people just check out the podcast on FriendFeed. And you can always find us on Twitter. In FriendFeed, we have a FriendFeed room for Coast to Coast Bio.
The URL is friendfeed.com/coast-to-coast-bio. So it's Coast to Coast Bio with all dashes. And the two
words
is actually T-O and not the numeral two.
Yeah. And you can always, of course, find us on our blogs. Hurry is, go ahead.
Code-itch.com is what I mostly write about because all I do now is coding.
Yeah. And I am mndoci.com, where you can read Business Bytes, Genes and Molecules. You can also find me on Twitter at mndoci, pretty much everywhere as mndoci. And Hurry is...
H-A-R-I-J-A-Y. That's Hurry J on just about everything as well.
Excellent. And you can always write to us, hurry@bioscreencast.com, or drop our word on the friend feed room, or leave us links on Delicious, 4:C2CBio, number 2, in the middle. And that's it for today.
Outstanding. All right. Thanks a lot.
See you next week.
Bye.
Bye-bye.